Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. Joining me today is consumer editor Jeremy Korsniewski. Happy December.
I can't believe that today is December 1st. The day that we're recording this is December 1st. It's crazy to me.
This, I think November was one of the fastest months I've ever lived through. But hey, it's December. It's the holiday season. We're going to talk about some winter beers later on in the podcast. A little bit all over the place. Some of mine, admittedly, are a little cliche. But hey, that's okay. You know, why not? It's December, have a beer. And but as far as things we're driving, I drove the BMW X4M in competition trim. So that's really quite something. And Jeremy and I have both driven the Hyundai Elantra in hybrid trim. So kind of both ends of the spectrum here. So that should be kind of fun to get into. We do have an update on spending your money. And we also will talk about some of the best used cars and trucks and SUVs for $10,000. So let's jump right in. I literally just got out of the X4M, like I said, in competition trim. It's a lot of car, a lot of crossover. You know, I think there's a lot of debate sometimes when we like try to explain these things, like, is this really an M car? Well, this requires you to really rethink your definition of an M. Now, if you like raw power, if you like that styling, if you like the sports seats, you like, you know, the suspension and the steering, and the engine can be as aggressive as you'd like. It has that, you know, that good sort of BMW M tuning setup in the middle of the car, and it's a serious performance machine. That's my initial takeaway. I could say this. I could see if you were like looking for a sporty crossover, like that's what you wanted, and then you're also an enthusiast or someone who just wants the most power and performance they could get, and this is the size and shape of a vehicle you want, then this is your thing. Candidly, it wouldn't be mine. I would definitely go with like an M3 or something, or an M5. Or if I was going to go with a crossover, I would just go with like an X4 or like a Ford Explorer or Expedition or something. Like, I guess sometimes when you get in these crossover coupe things, to me, it gets a little muddied. I also generally like things like the Porsche Cayenne and Porsche Macan a little bit better when it comes to just sportiness versus some of these, like an X4 that is the crossover coupe styled sort of thing. But I mean, you can't argue with just the raw performance, you know, 3-liter twin turbo inline six. It's really potent, over 500 horsepower, 503 to be specific. They retune the ECU, and you get a unique exhaust, which I'm actually now reading from Joel Stocksdale's First Drive, which was over a year and a half ago. It's been a while since we've actually driven this.
Wow.
Thing. Yeah. Sounds amazing. It really cackles and growls. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what it is. I probably should have, I've buried the lead. It's like lime green, booger green, like it's bright green. It's like the craziest, limiest, yellowish, greenish color you would ever see. So I've been driving around town with it. It's a little cold out. I had a little bit of snow earlier this week. You know, just, you know, very typical like X4 things, but not really X4M things. So, you know, that's where it stands.
So you drove the competition model, correct?
That's right.
Okay. So the standard X4M is 473 horsepower. Mm-hmm. The one that you drove is what now?
Mine is about $87,000. 86, 87.
$87,000. And what's the horsepower?
503.
I mean, let's just pause for a moment and reflect on the fact that you can get a 503 horsepower crossover coupe from BMW in the year 2022.
Let's pause and reflect on that. Yes.
Yeah, it's a little crazy.
Yeah.
It's almost kind of a I do want to hear your commentary on do you prefer the crossover coupe-ish look, feel, and capabilities of an X4, or would you advise people, or if you were spending your own money, would you go straight for the X5, which is basically the same thing, except with considerably more utility and a, you know, if you think that the crossover coupe is a sporty shape, a little bit less of a sporty shape.
X5 for sure. I do too. The X4 is okay. It's attractive, but just to me, if you're going to go with a crossover, get the actual crossover,
right?
You know, so.
No, I feel the same way. Ever since BMW started doing this with the first X6, which actually the X4, I've got this backwards. The X4 is the crossover coupe version of the X3.
Right.
The X6
right.
is the crossover coupe version of the. But when you actually start pricing them, because BMW charges more for less utility, for less vehicle in the even numbered vehicles, which are the sportier versions of the odd number vehicles, but you go up a number, not down, like I had said a minute ago. So if you're listening, don't send us emails. That was a quick slip, but we corrected. I totally agree with you. So I don't understand exactly why you choose an X4 over an X3, especially when you can get a really nice, larger sized X5 with crazy horsepower. For you know, not a large price disparity, but also, like, this is a trend with BMW. Just this week, BMW unveiled their new XM, which is only the second M badged model after the classic and iconic M1. So you know, clearly this is not a segment or a marketplace trend that BMW is going to be ignoring moving forward.
Yeah, I think it's BMW, I think, was really the first, even before Mercedes, to start, you know, rolling out like performance models in these kind of tweener segments.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. I mean, they're really trying to, I think, almost fill in every single blank somewhat unnecessarily, you know. I mean, I will say this, if you want a crossover and you want, like some of the BMW dynamics, familiar ones, like the steering and the chassis setup, and you want a lot of power. I mean, that's kind of the sandwich you're making here, if you will. You know, I don't know. When I look at X4 and X6, I can see the X6 a little bit more than the X4. 'Cause at that point, it's still a pretty big vehicle. The X4 is not a small vehicle. It's, you know, it's larger than it's ever been. I remember when mm-hmm. these cars first came out, I feel like it was at the Detroit Auto Show, like back-to-back years. Like I remember covering it, like, oh, mm-hmm. 5 and 6 or 6 and 7 or 5 and 7. I don't know. I remember being there for that.
Right.
So, you know, and give them credit. They sell plenty. But,
right. Yeah. They wouldn't keep doing it if they weren't making money on these. And I think that was one of the big questions when they unveiled, was like, are people going to pay more for, you know, ostensibly less vehicle? And the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I'm not one to criticize another person's choice. If they, you know, if they want the quote unquote sportier version, with, you know, less practicality, more power to them. I mean, it's their money. They can spend it however they want. But it makes just so much more sense to me in a day in, day out living with a vehicle standpoint to choose the full fat version with a lot more cargo space. Because why are you living with the compromises of a crossover in the first place if you don't need the utility of it? So it's a fashion statement, and you know, good on BMW for defining this segment and sticking with it, and they're doing well with it. Real quick, I want to know what you think of this BMW XM. While we're on the topic of BMW crossovers, it's very controversial to say the least.
I like it, but I also have been okay with the. Like the grill on, like the kind of the crazy grill that, you know, we've seen in some of the like more recent BMWs. So I don't mind the risks. I think if you look over BMW's history, they've had some pretty crazy designs. It's just not how they typically are. But every now and then, like once a decade, they do something that makes everybody stand back and go, what are we doing here? What is this? And a lot more often than not, they end up being iconic. So I'm okay with it. It almost reminds me of like a Lexus or a Hyundai, though, in some ways. But I mean, it's very significant because, like you said, it's like this would only be the second like standalone M model since the M1. Yeah. So, which I mean, that's an icon when you look at it, but also kind of a risky car. So
yeah, and it to be fair, this is being shown in concept form, the XM. So I'm sure that changes will be made, but I think BMW more than any other automaker is showing right now that they're not afraid to push boundaries when it comes to styling. I'm just going to go on the record as saying I don't like this the way that this thing looks, but I will give credit where credit is due. BMW is not backing down from their you know styling direction and their current design direction. And if you're gonna do it, go all the way. Like this is how I felt with you. I mean, remember the Acura ZDX? It was like Honda Acura's sporty crossover coupe thing 10-12 years ago. And you know, at the time when I first saw it, I was like, yikes. And then I saw it in person and test drove one and spent a week with it. And I'm like, you know what? Like, kudos to them for not backing down and taking something to its like ultimate peak. And I still don't love that era of Acuras, but if I'm pointing at one and saying, you know, that one's memorable, it's the ZDX. And I kind of feel like the XM, and now, like we said, it's concept form right now, but we'll see what the production version, and I'm sure it's going to push boundaries like the concept has. We might look back on this era of, you know, BMWs with the grill and the, you know, the kind of the crazy sharp creases and lines and sort of eschewing their classic look for something that pushes new boundaries. Maybe we'll look at this one and say like, well, that's the memorable one. Like that is the one that stands out from this period as like the quintessential BMW of, you know, the 2020s. But we'll see.
I can almost see though, when I look at this picture, like flipping through the gallery, how this is going to come together. And I don't think it'll be as insane as like we think, you know, like I can see how like, you know, it's really the front and the back end. That's a little cartoonish. Some of the other parts I think will just kind of morph into something a little more like civilized. So we'll see. I mean, I would say they're high on my list of companies that is like really going after it. And right. I like that. So
yeah, kudos and credit where credit's due. I don't have to like it. I think enough people like it that it, you know, that they're going to have a success with it. And, you know, speaking of companies that are kind of pushing new styling boundaries, I think Hyundai, Kia, Genesis qualifies as well. That it brings to mind the current Hyundais and, you know, not to steal a potential segue break from you, Greg, but while we're on the idea of, or on the topic of like, pushing boundaries with styling, I think the Hyundai Elantra,
yes,
which is the next vehicle that we're going to talk about, qualifies. Like, if you look at the Elantra's lineage leading up to this new 2021 edition, 2021 is a complete divergence from anything they've done. And I think previous Elantras have been like no one's going to look at it and say like, whoa, that thing looks amazing. But also, no one's going to look at it and say like, I could never drive that, I hate it. Whereas this new 2021 version falls into the latter camp. Like I could see a lot of people looking at it and saying like, oh, I hate that, it's so ugly. However, it's different, it's memorable, and it gives people a reason to pick it over, you know, some of the more boring, I don't want to say boring, maybe less dramatic designs. Like, you know, obviously the Toyota Corolla and the new Honda Civic is brand new for this year as well. But it's boring by comparison, if you were to park the Elantra next to a Civic and a Corolla, the Elantra is obviously the one that is going to draw your eye because it's got such a different design with like sharp angles, kind of pontoon fenders, almost a beak of sorts up front. So again, I kind of similar with what's going on with BMW. I personally don't love it. Like I don't look at it and say like, whoa, that's the groundbreaking design I've been waiting for. But I'm glad that they're doing something different and aren't just trying to blend in. Do you have any thoughts on that, Greg?
So I drove the Elantra, it was a while ago, and in mm-hmm. hybrid trim, and I didn't use a lot of fuel because I didn't drive very much, candidly. But it was a very, I remember exactly what I did with it. I went to get my eyes checked for the first time in, it was over a year at this point, just because I wasn't going to the eye doctor during lockdowns. Right. I could see right. good enough. And I'm like, we'll go from there. But there's a lot of things about the Elantra I like, especially the way the cabin is set up. Everything is within reach. I think you get a lot of value for the price. Even at the very bottom of the Elantra portfolio, you still mm-hmm. get a lot of stuff. I think they make creative use of materials. So even though it doesn't really look expensive, or it's not expensive, but it also doesn't feel cheap. And I think Hyundai does a good job at that. Because sometimes cars at this price point, they do look cheap, and that's because they are cheap. And that's like a totally fair assessment. So I've always thought Hyundai does a good job of setting up their interiors. I think their infotainment systems are usually pretty good to use. The hybrid is, to me, it's like, this is a car that I got in the high 30s MPG as I think back. So like, it's like, you get a lot for what you're spending here, mm-hmm. It's a pretty good value, I think, in the hybrid space. It's fun to drive too. It's kind of a little torquey,
It's got an electric motor, which, which adds a little bit of torquey boost to the around town driving. I haven't driven the regular one. I hear that the base engine, extremely non-memorable. The hybrid I think is the one to pick. The base one I think is a 2 liter with 147 horsepower and 132 pound feet. And I think it gets 33 miles per gallon combined. Mm-hmm. The hybrid is a 1.6 liter, but it's got an additional 32 kilowatt electric motor. So the full horsepower on that is 139, which is less than the 147 of the base engine.
Yeah.
But it's 195 pound feet of torque as opposed to 132. So that's what you're going to notice around town driving. 195 pound feet of torque is a stout amount for a non-performance efficiency minded sedan. I did better than you in fuel economy. I got 48 miles per gallon in my week of driving with it. But I didn't ever, it's not the kind of vehicle that I'm going to take on back roads and pound. So it's just like driving to the grocery store, running some errands, just this and that, like your typical your typical driving. And I'll just put it this way. I'd much rather drive that every day than a Prius, which gets similar mileage. And the Elantra doesn't feel like you're making sacrifices for that kind of efficiency like a Prius does. It's definitely an option that I would be drawn to. Also, I remember thinking when I was driving it, that it is the kind of vehicle that just makes so much sense for a huge percentage of the population. There's a lot of people that are not ready to make a switch to electric vehicles. A hybrid like the Elantra hybrid, and it was the limited trim that I had, is like a great gateway car into the efficiency sweepstakes, so to speak. Maybe kind of to whet your appetite on how little gas you could use, how you can save a lot of money and not feel like you're penalizing yourself, so that maybe the next go round, 5-6 years later, and EVs are more mainstream, every automaker has them in every size and price category, and there's more charging stations built up, then, maybe you'll be ready, on the next go round. And it's roomy. It's got plenty of space. It's like the size of your family car from what you grew up with that your family used for everything. Like imagine the, you know, mid-90s Ford Taurus or Honda Accord or Toyota Camry. The current Elantra is about the same size. It's got just as much space inside and a nice big trunk that is, you know, very useful, very practical. So, and it's not particularly expensive. I did a quick little price check. It starts at $28,100 in limited trim. So that gets you the, the hybrid powertrain. It gets you the big 10.25 navigation screen, heated and ventilated leather seats, all the goodies that you expect out of a modern car. And it's the kind of car that probably most people should be buying as their day in, day out family commuting vehicle.
I should probably restate my numbers. Looking at the numbers, you could get in the 50s as far as like EPA ratings. I think I'm misremembering. I don't think I got in the 30s, unless it was like a really like short drive where I was just mashing the throttle. My guess is it was probably at least in the 40s. So it just
we know how you drive, Greg.
It's possible. Maybe I got in the 20s. I don't know. I'm probably not getting that in the X4M. That's for sure.
last thought on this Elantra before we move on.
Yeah.
I like that Hyundai is pushing boundaries on styling. I like that they're trying new things in the interior too. One that I had the full digital gauge cluster. One knock that I'll give it is I don't think that the current interior style is going to age well. I think these current Hyundai kind of, I don't know how to put it. Like, it looks like there is a tablet mounted on the dash for the infotainment screen. That's a look and feel that we've gotten used to. It also kind of looks like there's a tablet directly behind the steering wheel where the gauge cluster sits. And it's they don't try to hide the fact that it's a rectangular screen sitting there. It's not like they're not going out of their way to integrate it with the rest of the dash, make it look like it's flowing in there, cover it with an extra large glass screen so it looks like it's all one piece. It literally looks like there's a screen in front of you. And I think as far as like minimalist design goes, that's not a bad way to do it. To try to hide the fact of, you know, that this is a techie thing. Just put it there and it is what it is. But I think they could do a little bit better job with the finishing on it. Directly to the left of that digital gauge cluster, there is like a what looks like a circular dial that lights up, but it actually is nothing. It doesn't do anything. It just sits there. It doesn't change. It doesn't move. It's like a little bit of a styling flourish that I feel like doesn't fit and doesn't make sense with the rest of it. I'd rather have a button there or, you know, just a blank plate since that, you know, they didn't go out of their way to blend it all together. That seems out of place to me. And I think that this current trend, I doubt it's going to stick forever. I think we're going to get into more organic shapes again in the future or just very plain straight lines. I think that also works. But if you're going to do that, you got to go all the way. And, that weird little light up gauge there, just it's the kind of thing that would bug me over time. Like, why is that there? That doesn't do anything. But your mileage may vary. Maybe you don't care.
I do think the exterior design probably won't age well either, to your point about just how design, you know, can evolve over time. And I think Hyundai does a really good job of taking a risk for a generation and then change it. And usually that's what we've seen since like the Sonata, you know, about 10, 12 years ago, very aggressive, you know, very kind of out there. Then they came back, then they kind of lost it a little bit. They went a little too conservative, then they went back there. Yeah. And I think you see that reflected across their lineup. Ralph Giels, who's the head of design for Stellantis, has a great line. I remember sitting at a design forum with him probably 10 years ago. And he said something like, well, you know, good design is timeless. And then he kind of said as an aside, bad design is timeless too. It's still bad, you know, and he's right. You know, that's kind of how it goes. But right. Overall, I think everything we've talked about on the show so far is like stuff that's out there, but you know, we'll look back at it as sort of like, that's what the early 2020s were, you know, this isn't going to be some design that resonates into the 40s. So,
yeah, I think sometimes having something that is just like of the time is okay. Like we look back at 90s cars right now that are making a resurgence, you know, like you look at, you can go way back to the 70s. You look at a, you know, Burt Reynolds, Smokey and the Bandit Trans Am, and you're like, dude, that is so 70s. I love it.
Yeah.
80s are doing that too. Like if people see Fox Body Mustangs and they're like, oh, Vanilla Ice, man, you know, like that in 90s are making a huge comeback, with, Radwood. And I think it's okay to be of the era. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of, you know, with BMW's current, design language and Hyundai's current design language, I think that's fine, but I don't think that it's timeless. Right. So I mean, 20 years from now, maybe we'll, listen to this podcast and be, you know, making commentary on it, but, we'll see.
So let's talk about some used cars.
Let's do it.
We compiled a couple of lists for 10 grand, which is a pretty aggressive price point right now. The average new car price we're seeing is about 40. I've seen 45, as high as that, which is insane. It was like 38, 39, 40 for years, recent years anyway. But a couple lists here. If you're looking for just like something to drive around maybe in the winter, or you need like a second car, or you're just looking for something because, hey, it's fun to shop for cars. A lot of good choices here. I'm going to tell you which of these I would go with, but just kind of take us through the list here real quick, the lists real quick.
Sure. I broke it down into two parts. I broke it down in like sedan hatchback, and then I did a whole separate list for crossovers and SUVs because that's what everybody's buying right now. On the used cars for 10,000, so this barring hatchbacks and, or excuse me, this is barring crossovers and SUVs. I'll run down the list real quick. It is, there's an Acura TSX, there's a BMW 3 Series, Chevy Volt, Ford Fusion, Honda Accord, Honda Fit, Lexus GS350, Mazda Miata, Nissan Leaf. That is the list at $10,000 for sedans and hatchbacks. On the crossovers, the list, crossovers and SUVs, starts with the Kia Soul, and these are by size and segment. So starting subcompact Kia Soul, compact Honda CR-V, midsize SUV, Jeep Grand Cherokee, a very specific set of model years there. You can see the reasoning in the article. Midsize luxury crossover, RX 350 400H from Lexus. Midsize three-row Acura MDX. Again, there's a reason to choose a specific set of years to get transmission that's not going to cost you thousands to repair. Large crossover Ford Flex. Large luxury SUV with three rows, Lexus GX 470. And the absolute big daddy of the group, the 2008 Nissan Armada full-size SUV. That's the traditional body and frame truck-based SUV on the list. So those are the numbers, or those are the entries. Curious to hear your commentary, Greg, on what you like off of it.
The cars are so intriguing to me because there's a lot of stuff on here that is either practical or fun or both, like the Miata or the Volt. I mean, if you just need a like either a fun car or a commuter car, I mean, boom, here you go. The Volt to me was a really I mean, I guess I can't say it didn't get enough credit for what it was, because I mean, back in 08, 09, we acted like it was the moon landing, which it kind of was, but it just turned out to be a very good hybrid sedan. And you can still get one that's not that old and drive it for 4 or 5 years and drive a hybrid and not use much gas. So, I mean, to me, that's a very practical one.
I totally agree with you. I think this $10,000 sedan list can be broken down in a couple of ways, but the number one recommendation that I would make off the list is the Volt, like you just said, for all the reasons you just said. Four doors, a good size cargo space, excellent fuel mileage, and you don't feel like you're being penalized for choosing something practical and efficient.
I do like the 3 Series, though, recommendation. I actually started to go down the rabbit hole here. I went into our used car section. There, it looks like near me, there's a pretty nice 09 3 Series. It's a 328i, 91,000 miles for about $8,500. That's kind of nice. Then here's another one, an 01 3 Series. So you're getting even a little bit older. It's convertible. It's for $8,000. This is the 325 CI. I got to click on that. What am I looking at here? This is, so when I picture like the kind of car I just want to like in the summer, like throw my golf clubs in and just like not drive far, but drive fun, if you will. This is like what I'm looking for right here. It's, this is pretty great. Let's see if it's where it is. Oh, this is interesting. This is not that far from me. Well, it's a little far from me, but, yeah, 6 cylinders. So it's got the straight 6,
which is what you want.
Yeah, exactly. It's got the automatic though. Car like this.
I'll tell you, you mentioned that 328.
Yeah.
That was that a sedan or a coupe?
It's a coupe. It's convertible.
Oh, well, that's the 325 you're looking at now.
Yes. Sorry. I clicked over to that one. Yep.
Yeah. There was a 328 that you found. And I think that's kind of like a sweet spot in those models. The 328 later became a turbocharged 4-cylinder.
Yeah.
But in this era we're talking about, the 328 was just one of the most smoothest, silkiest inline sixes you'll ever come across, which is saying a lot because inline sixes are inherently smooth and silky. Maybe not the Jeep 4-liter that was also an inline six, but traditionally BMW's inline sixes. This is like one of the very sweetest engines that you're ever going to find. And the fact that they've fallen down into that less than $10,000 price bracket makes them really attractive as a quote unquote beater.
Yeah.
Which you don't have to treat, you know, we use that as a term. You don't have to treat a car, you don't have to beat it for it to be a beater. It just means it's not the one that you're making a $700 a month car payment on and you're afraid of every ding and scratch and thing that your child spills in the back seat. We're just talking about, this is the car that that you're going to drive every single day, load up with miles, and not feel bad about. And for that kind of thing, man, that era of 3 Series is hard to beat.
I would say too that the you know, if you even want to step up and be a little more practical and go to like the 328, you know, you're getting a newer car. This one is specifically newer, but I mean, it can be what you want it to be. It could be, like I said, your golfing and go car, or it could be like this 09. If I needed a car, I would look at this one and maybe call this guy up, you know, because probably it's got 4 or 5 years left in it. Now, granted, a BMW is not going to be a cheap thing to maintain, so you got to deal with that. But
yeah. And I kind of sort of mentioned that in the write-up too. And if you're listening to this and you find this topic interesting, you should definitely go check it out. Leave a comment and let us know what you think. But the BMWs of that era, it was right when they were adding things like variable valve timing, which I think they call their Vanos system. It's just prior to when they started turbocharging the 3-liter inline six. But there's an era there that, and it's the one that we're talking about, the one that has really fallen down into easily attainability for someone who's got any sort of job, that didn't have the variable valve timing. They didn't have high pressure oil systems. They didn't have like these direct injection systems that tend to foul up. It was kind of like peak analog, so to speak, and they're not analog. They're computer controlled and all that. You know, they're not old school carbureted engines. But there's a certain simplicity to these late '90s to mid 2000s vehicles that makes them easier on a livability and repairability standpoint for your typical mechanic. Less likely to cost you an arm and a leg when something does go wrong, which it will.
Real quick on your SUV list, a lot of stuff here that, I mean, is either fun or practical or both. I don't think I'd do the Armada, but the Lexus GX 470, buy an 03, you're fine. Buy an 09 and you probably got another SUV for 10 more years. You know, that Lexus is going to run forever. Everybody, I think at Auto, not everybody, but a lot of people at Autoblog love the Flex. Just, it's so huge. And I actually just had this thought the other day. I was walking through the neighborhood and like that 08 to 10 Grand Cherokee, right before the redesign, sort of like Chrysler's first redesign for the Grand Cherokee out of bankruptcy. The Grand Cherokee, that was like the first thing they showed. And they showed a concept before anything else, almost to show like, hey, we do have new vehicles. We're alive. I remember showing this thing. And then the journalists were like, when is this going to be on sale? They're like 2 years from now or something like that. Point being, though, is this kind of like, it almost has like a military vibe with those fender flares. I could see this generation really getting some love. You know, it's going to be still, I think, pretty affordable, definitely practical transportation. I always liked it. I think it's a very interesting design. Maybe if an XJ is too expensive or too high maintenance for you, this is something. It's at this point, it's still basically a used SUV.
Yeah. Yeah, and I specifically called out two follow-ups on what you said. I specifically called out the 2008 to 2010 Grand Cherokee for a couple of reasons.
Yeah.
It was the latter version of this like real blocky design. We talked about like standing the test of time. I think this design is going to stand the test of time because it's
agreed.
Not
totally.
There's just not a whole lot of like oddness or weirdness or you know, it's like a two-box SUV. There's just enough styling flourish to make it interesting, but not so much that it's going to date it. And starting in 08, they got a slightly nicer interior. And, you know, anyone who was looking at Chrysler products, this was the Cerberus era. So it's when they were bought out by private equity money. And from everyone that I've talked to that worked at Chrysler Jeep at the time, including several relatives, they basically had to take huge cost-cutting measures to attain profitability and make the suits happy. And one way that they did that was by just drastically reducing the quality of interior materials. They started to see that that was affecting sales, and they were losing ground to some of their competitors. So the second wave of vehicles from this era tried to right some of those wrongs to the best of their ability. So a little bit softer touch plastics, a little bit cleaner lines, you know, more lit up switches, like just the usability it's like small things really made a big difference in the design. Also, the Hemi that you could get in, say, a 2008 Grand Cherokee, it was the lower power version before they switched to the newer high-tech valve train. But that's not necessarily a bad thing because it's still plenty of power. It's still a 5.7 liter Hemi V8 that's powering the thing. And these particular Hemis and the 5-speed transmission that they're made it up to, and the quadra drive or quadra track, transfer cases, four-wheel drive system, are very durable. It is not a bad choice for something that you're actually going to get some driving enjoyment out of and probably not get penalized with big repair and maintenance bills. So that was, you mentioned the Grand Cherokee. The last thing I'll say, the Lexus GX on this list is probably the very best bet. They have led the vehicle durability and reliability rankings for two decades, the Lexus GX. It's built on a platform, the Toyota Land Cruiser Prado platform, that is renowned worldwide for just being, this is the vehicle that if you're going to take into the Australian outback, this is the one you pick, because it's going to get you out of the Australian outback. You're not going to die of dehydration because your vehicle broke down and you had to like hike across a desert. Super reliable, super durable. One person left a comment in our story that they couldn't find one in the $10,000 range. So I did a quick little search. One little nuance of our website, if you're searching for used vehicles, you'll get better results if you put your zip code in and narrow it down. You'll get more results if you do that, then if you just like say, show me everything, it'll give you a greater, so set it to something like 500 miles. Don't just leave your zip code out. Set it to 500 miles and do the search. I found a 2004 with less than 140,000 miles on it for around $10,000, and another 2005 estate over. That is a vehicle that's very likely going to give years of good solid service without like putting you in the poorhouse with maintenance bills. It's a really, really solid choice if you happen to be constrained to this price category.
Check out both these pieces. We'll be promoting them throughout the month of December, just as we end the year. It's a good time for people who might be like used car shopping. December 26th is often a very big day for car purchases. So check these out. Nice work, Jeremy. I enjoyed going through them. It resonates with me because there's usually a 3 Series that's in my budget, and then some SUVs that I remember going on the launches.
Right.
In my like first decade in the industry or something.
We're showing our age.
Right. All right. So real quick, this morning I posted my last column of the year. We rotate through our columns. It was my turn. This is actually round 5 of our columns for the year. So I kicked it off. So I thought it'd be a good time, December 1st, just to reflect on all the EVs I've driven. 8 of them really stuck out with me. So check that out. My list includes Rivian, Lucid, Mercedes EQS, Mach-E, what else am I missing here? I'll pull up the story. But so
Mercedes EQS.
EQS, ID4.
You have the Hyundai Ioniq 5 on this list too.
Ioniq 5 and the Hummer. So there we go. That's all 8 of them. I caught myself flat-footed on something I wrote like hours ago. First of all, check out the story, a little self-plug here. But for me, and I'd like to hear what you think here, Jeremy. Mm-hmm. 2021, this is like the year that EVs really just became such a thing. Like, you could order a Lucid right now if you want to. You can't get the Air Dream performance thing that me and John Lovitz tested out. If you read the article, you see what I mean. You probably can't get like some of the first editions, but a lot of these startup companies like Rivian just went public. They're bringing their cars out to you. I can't wait to drive the Fisker. That's going to be another interesting one. Joel, I think, drove the old Karma, which was a Fisker at one point.
Right.
These things are out there. Like, you don't need to get on some secret like Tesla waiting list and tweet Elon to get these things. Like, You could order a Bolt. You can't get one because they're fixing the ones from 2021 before they start building the ones in 2022. And that was another part of the list. I think the Bolt was one of my favorite EVs because it drives really well. It's fun. The inside feels futuristic, but just the recall. It's such like, like a toe stub, you know? EQS was a car from the future. Lucid, I think, was the most beautiful thing I drove this year, just full stop. And the Mach-E and the Hummer, I think, to kind of put a point on this, those are two of the ones that were like super hyped, but really didn't live up to expectations for me. So here's 2022.
I haven't had a chance to drive all these EVs that you did this year. I consider me jealous. So I'll run down and give like a brief thought on each one of them. The Hummer EV, I think, is going to be pretty darn epic. It's also way out of reach for most buyers that are listening to this podcast, myself included, but I'm glad it exists or will exist soon. The Lucid Air Dream Performance, I think, this one is super expensive, this particular version that they're leading with. They'll sell them all, but I'm looking forward to some of the lower grade models start hitting the market, ones that are actually going to sell in real numbers. And I think that'll be a better test of how Lucid can compete in the coming years against Tesla. The Chevy Bolt, I haven't driven the new one. I've spent quite a bit of time in the previous generation and quite liked it. I think it's an excellent mainstream daily driven vehicle. Something that once they get the repair sorted out, you know, could potentially be on a future buy list for me, along with the BMW i3, which I also really like. Maybe less practical, a little bit more out there, but more interesting. The Volkswagen ID4, I really like the interior of these things. I think they did a really cool job making it seem like a next generation vehicle without going like full crazy on the interior. Big fan of that. The Ford Mustang Mach-E falls into a similar vein with an added degree of performance that the Volkswagen just doesn't have. So the Mach-E is one that I think is really going to break into the mainstream mindset with people, because it's a Mustang, it performs like a Mustang, it's within reach of a lot of buyers, and there's so many different versions of it that you can probably find the one you're looking for. The Mercedes EQS is that out there vehicle. It's like the S-class of electric cars. I doubt that they're going to sell in huge numbers because of just its price level, but I think it's pretty cool. The Rivian R1T is on my definitely in the future I'd like to own one of these lists, especially the truck. I love the fact that it's a truck with a usable bed in back, plenty of storage, and I could see myself owning one of these a decade from now and having it be my, you know, everyday vehicle. And I really, the last one on your list, the Hyundai Ioniq 5, I love what Hyundai, Kia, and Genesis are doing with this. I think, what is it, the EGMP platform, mm-hmm. I think is what it's called. Each one of them stands out. It's a really cool design. The Ioniq, I can't think what the Kia version's called off the top of my head right now. EV6, is that
EV6,
right?
EV6, that's it, yep.
EV6. Such a cool looking kind of sporty hatchback shape. And the Genesis GV60, I think, is on the same platform as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really intriguing design. So 2021 is the year that I think EVs broke into the mainstream consciousness. I'd like to see 2022 be the year that they break into the mainstream, like, car buying purchase decision argument for people. So more to come on that. I mean, I know that they're coming. The products are there. The infrastructure is coming along. The consumer mindset is like that, like the last piece of the puzzle. And I think, you know, I'm not going to comment on politics at all, other than to say, if things pass like they seem like they could, and the incentives get better to kind of make some people, it'll push them over the edge into EV ownership, I think that's a really cool thing. So yeah, we'll see.
I think that's where you can see, you know, government perhaps helping with the infrastructure or incentivizing the infrastructure or something, because that makes it easier for consumers to get access to these things.
Right.
Like, I tried to include a downside for the vehicles in my column that had downsides. Like, it was the bullet recall. It was Volkswagen lying about the name of their company. But the Mach-E had a little bit of kind of a toe stub that I don't think anybody really, really remembers. And that's that the level 2 charger you could purchase, there was a stop sale for that back in the spring. Mm. And I couldn't really find, when I went back just last night, like, it doesn't look like you could buy one on Ford anymore or add it to your, like, when you're trying to order your Mach-E. Obviously, you could get another, you know, level 2 charger. Like, you get one on Amazon or something.
Yeah, but you can buy them at your local Home Depot, too.
Right. But I kind of liked the Ford app that came with the Mach-E, the way you could set the charging. So I liked all that integration. So, but this is a new technology. It's tricky, you know? Yeah.
I'll drink to that, Greg.
I was just going to say, rather than worry about this, let's have a beer.
let's do it.
I have, it's our winter beer list time. Calendar flips, we got to start talking about winter beers. I've got a few, and I know you have a few too. Yours are definitely more like, you know, in the weeds, microbrews, which is cool. I'll lead off with my Bell's Expedition Stout. This is like kind of a go-to beer for me. I like Bell's. They recently, I believe the founding family is selling, like selling out, if you will, to like, just it's time for them to sort of like sell out. They're getting older. So it's not going to be the largest Michigan independent brewery anymore. Hey, that's okay. I still love their beer. You know, so there's that. But I just think this is a good beer. It's somebody gave it to me, I think, a few years ago. I don't even know how I came across it. It was like, I don't know if I left like a party and just like one of them showed up in my cooler somehow, like one of those random things. And then I tried it. And I was like, ooh, this is good. You know, and it's nice. A stout, and it's just got a nice, it's a full bodied beer, obviously. The ABV is 10.5. So one or two, and that's all you need. Maybe have one and then switch to something else, or have like a couple of like Bud Lights or something. And then this is your like evening beer by the fire. Very malty. It's got almost like, you know, like there's almost like a chocolate feel to it. But it, to me, it doesn't drink like a 10% beer. That's why I like it. Is I don't like, as you can see by what I'm about to mention, I like lighter beers, even like my regular beers. I like them to be more like in the 4%-ish range. This is just a good, nice beer around the fire, though.
Nice.
So that's what I'm going to go with. Have you ever tried it?
Not this one in particular. I'm pretty familiar with Bell's.
Yeah.
Being here in Columbus, you know, we get a lot of Ohio breweries.
Yeah.
But Bell's one of the ones from Michigan that is always stocked on store shelves. So I've added it to my list the next time I go grocery shopping. I'm gonna pick some up at your recommendation.
It's pretty good. Like I said, you don't want to drink all six of them at once, but you know,
duly noted.
One or two is good. Tell me about your beers. Are these from Ohio or are they?
One of them is Ohio-ish.
Okay.
I came up with two. I've actually made this recommendation before on a previous podcast. I don't even know how you say this. I'm Polish. I don't speak Polish.
Okay.
So I don't know how you pronounce these letters. Z-Y-W-I-E-C. I'm going to guess that it's something like Zydek or something like that. But I've always been able to get them here in Ohio when I moved out and lived in Phoenix, when I lived in Seattle. I could find these everywhere. I think that they're imported by one of the big name brand importers. AB InBev, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, they're actually owned by Heineken, which we'll get to that. But go ahead.
Okay. All right. But this is a Polish beer. It's in the Baltic Porter style. It is a high ABV as well. I don't know if it's what exactly it is. I'd have to look again, but it's
9.5 according to Beer Advocate.
9.5.
Yeah.
9.5.
Gorgeous label, by the way, too. I'm just looking at
this. It's like black, red, and gold.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great beer. And they sell them in pints too. And they're not expensive. You know, I'll hit my local stop. I just walk to it from my house and I'll grab one of these and then maybe like a lighter hazy IPA or something. And I'm set for like an entire football game.
Yeah.
It's a great beer. I highly recommend it. Give it a try if you can find it.
The
other one, go ahead. Sorry, Greg.
Just IPAs. I was drinking these heavy IPAs a couple years ago. Speaking of football games, when Michigan State's offense was so terrible, it was like, you could not watch like Bud Light. You needed like, and I like Michigan State football. So it was like you needed like at least a 6% ABV to watch a game.
Yeah.
I digress. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you asked about Ohio beers.
Yeah.
So BrewDog, I've mentioned BrewDog in previous podcasts as well. I'm hitting that well again.
BrewDog's good stuff.
It's great. Yeah, it's They're actually from the UK. I believe they started in Scotland. And I think they're pretty big over in the UK. The only place that they do business in the United States is in Columbus, Ohio, and the surrounding areas. But they're pretty sizable. So it, you know, if you live in the Midwest, you probably be able to find some BrewDog. Some of their flagship brews, the Punk IPA and the Elvis Juice, which is a grapefruit IPA. They're pretty easy to find. I'm narrowing it down to something a little bit stranger. They have they have a brand that they call Overworks.
Okay.
It's like their experimental brand. I don't know how easy they are to find outside the state of Ohio. However, if you go to their website, you can buy directly from the website. And if your state laws allow it, they'll ship it to you. So the one that I chose was their Overworks Boysenberry. Like I said, Overworks is like their experimental brand. They do a lot of like farmhouse beers and sour beers, which, you know, I'm only ever in the mood for like a sour,
right?
But I really like them. So the Boysenberry is my pick, but they do several different, adjuncts in a similar style fashion, a similar sour style fashion. And they're excellent. It pours like a deep ruby red color, almost like a ruby red grapefruit. Yeah. It's got like, it's lighter on the carbonation, which makes it really drinkable. It's got a great sour flavor and the Boysenberry adds a tartness to it. It's really, really well-rounded. If you like sour beers, I highly recommend giving it a try. And it actually works really well in this cold weather. It's kind of heavy, like not syrupy heavy, but it's not a light beer by any means. It's not super high in ABV. It's probably in the 5-6%. I'm not looking at it in front of me, but, yeah, it drinks like something heavy that you know, if you're dressed in a sweater or something, it feels appropriate.
That's in general how I feel about like porters and stouts is like mm-hmm. sweater beers. You know, you drink them October-ish if it gets cold up here in the upper Midwest. Good time for that. And yeah. then right through into March. Because, I mean, right when you get that like first thaw, that's when suddenly it's like, okay, it's time to go with something, you know, a little bit different. Bell's actually has like an Oarsman ale. There's just some like, if you really get into beers, there's literally some like March beers. That's when you get some of the Belgians in there that can be pretty mm-hmm. good.
Totally.
So I like to be seasonal. My only problem is I tend to buy like a sixer or a 12er, drink like two of them, and then, you know, whatever. I forget about it, don't have a beer for a while. So I still have a bunch of fall beers. And it's December, which I guess I just need to drink them. That's the solution there is, you know, get beyond them.
There you go. I mean, your solution is to drink beer. It's not all bad.
And I do have, I'll close here. I like Stella Artois and I like Heineken for like December specifically. Heineken all year round. But I love the commercials. The Stella commercials with like the old Citroën, the Holiday Heineken. I remember they used to do the 5-pack where the guy was wrapping up a present and you drink a Heineken and it's like, hey, where's the sixth Heineken? I think I will likely have a Heineken tonight. I need to go downstairs and chill it. I do remember speaking of old holidays, I think I still have some Guinness down there, which is getting me from St. Patrick's Day, which I don't think beer really goes bad. I might throw that in there. Just have a stout. I think we're going to make some pasta tonight. So
nice.
You got to have a beer while you're waiting for the water to boil, like mixing up. I have this like 5-ingredient kind of sauce I make. You know, while you're doing all that, I don't know how you don't have a beer or a glass of wine or something. So
yeah, we just made pasta on the Thanksgiving holiday.
Nice.
My wife and I got down and we each made our own raviolis.
Ooh, ravioli is awesome.
Yeah, we popped open a bottle of red wine while we were doing that. I'm totally with you on that. And also, you know, if it sounds like I only drink weird out there beers that you've never heard of, that is absolutely not true. I've been drinking a lot of Yingling Black and Tans.
Yeah, those are good.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's you know, a traditional Black and Tan is what, Guinness and Bass, I think.
Yes, I'm thinking back to my college days actually.
Yeah, so you mix those two and you end up with something in the middle. And they're just really drinkable. And Yingling makes one. It's just called a Black and Tan. And people in the Midwest know Yingling for sure. It's probably available everywhere. I think they're America's oldest brewery, actually, out of Pennsylvania, I think. But yeah, like I'll knock back one of those with dinner. You know, I don't break out the real weird, strange stuff on a day in, day out basis.
All right. So let us know in the comments if you have any winter beer recommendations, holiday beer recommendations. You know, I think I was actually looking, I'm seeing ads for this thing called Drizzly where they send you beer to your door, which and wine. So that sounds good. Yeah. All right. Before I sound like too much of a lush, let's spend some money here. All right. Earl from episode 704 sent us an update. He had actually written to us asking, saying he has a Model 3 in 18. Should he sell it? Just try to flip it. And because he was thinking of getting another Model 3 or something else. And our advice at the time was, if you like the Model 3, don't do it. You know, like the extra money you're going to get isn't going to make much of a difference. But his update is he actually did. He's going to buy just something to get through winter, it sounds like, and go back to gasoline powered cars for a while. He sold the 2018 Model 3 for 40 grand. So he actually made $2,000 on this. We'll see what he drives. Maybe check out one of Jeremy's lists here, you know, if you need something for under 10 grand. And then he's going to look and see if he could get an i3, a Bolt, check, make sure they get the recall settled there, or maybe go up a bit and go with a Polestar 2, which I drove this year. John Snyder and I both really like the Polestar 2. It's a little understated, but if you get the single motor one, it's a little bit cheaper, you know, depending on where you live. You know, you might not really need all-wheel drive. So some things to consider there. But these all sound like good options. And hey, congratulations for making a couple of grand.
Yeah. The Model 3 actually is on the list of vehicles that is selling for more than people buy them for.
Yeah.
So I mean, selling when that's a thing, you know, maybe that makes sense. And I like your idea of buying a beater until you figure out your next choice. I really like the i3. You mentioned that. Yeah. And you mentioned the Polestar 2, Earl. Both of those are pretty cool vehicles. You mentioned buying a beater and going to gas for a little while. If you don't care about the brand, the one that stands out, we mentioned it earlier, is the Chevy Volt. You could buy one for less than $10,000. It's going to have all the practicality that you're likely in need of. And you know, you're going to get 40 miles of pure electricity on it, every single day, every time you plug it in, which hopefully is every single day. And then, you know, it's never going to leave you stranded without a charge either, because it's got the backup engine. So, you know, if you're looking at a beater and you don't want to spend very much money, it's hard to go wrong, with a Chevy Volt.
That's kind of a nice kind of bridge, actually, you know, go from electric back to a hybrid, then go back to electric. So
yep.
We can leave it there. Be safe out there. Don't drink and drive. Have a great first week of December. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everybody.